From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most thinking people consume news, but increasingly they get that news from untraditional, often unvetted sources. This at a time when the news media is under attack, as never before, from politicians who would like the news organizations to become a propaganda outlet. Former Charlotte Observer editor Rick Thames believes that part of the blame lies with the media itself for not doing a better job of explaining itself and how it works. But he also makes the case that a strong media is vital to holding power to account in his book, Why Local News, a memoir and plea for an endangered form of journalism. He shares his thoughts this hour on Charlotte Talks. First, the news. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The news media is going through tough times. It's being attacked by politicians who view news coverage they don't like as fake and biased. And it is experiencing the collapse of the business model that once supported major operations allowing newspapers, radio, and television to deploy vast resources to bring you the news that you need in a democracy. No media has suffered more than local news outlets. Newspapers have shuttered. Those that have stayed open have downsized drastically. And communities nationwide, including here in North Carolina, are increasingly bereft of local news coverage. If the job of journalism is to keep voters informed and to hold power to account, this is a nightmare. And not just for the industry, but for you. Rick Thames had a front row seat to all of this. He also came of age as a newspaper man in the heyday of those publications. Over the course of his career, he rose through the ranks, eventually becoming the editor of the Charlotte Observer at a time when they ruled the roost, a time when no one could touch them for the depth or breadth of their coverage. Well, now Thames has written a book about both his experiences and his prescriptions for what ails the industry. Why Local News, a memoir and plea for an endangered form of journalism is the name of that book, and Rick Thames joins us for the hour. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me here, Mike. You're welcome. Good to be with you all.
Let's start with public confidence in media. What do you think is driving that decline in confidence?
Well, it's a combination of things, but at root, a lot of it has to do with the loss of trust in journalists in general, and many factors come to play there. Some of it was not the fault of the journalists themselves. It was things that were being done to journalism. But at the end of the day, it's up to journalists to regain that trust, and I think that there are ways they can do that. Largely by listening to their audiences and giving them what they really need.
I mean, is the decline in confidence, the lack of trust, the loss of trust, is it because, as you said, things that were done to journalism, was it done to journalism by outside forces or by inside forces?
Well, it was a combination, but a lot of it was coming from the outside. Journalism at its base is not political, but a lot of politics came into play as people demonized journalism. And I first began to realize this, not at the Observer, but later as I was executive editor of the Wichita Eagle. And I would get these calls and emails from people who were, upset about some aspect that the Eagle was not covering. And for the longest time, I couldn't figure out what it was about. Well, so I finally figured out that it was the daily diatribe from Rush Limbaugh. So this was many years ago. And Rush Limbaugh was one of the earliest people that I could identify who did his best to undermine quality local journalism.
And the motivation for that was what, in your opinion?
Well, There was a political point of view, obviously, and he would tell you that he was an entertainer, not a journalist. But it was also financial. I think
Well,
it was a big.
if you say something is whatever it is, in this case, fake news, and you say it over and over and over again, and you're either a politician or you are a media star, and there's no question that Rush Limbaugh in his heyday, I think he was on 800 or so radio stations around the country, and largely responsible for the right-wing shift in certain media outlets. When you say it day after day, it becomes the truth to a whole lot of people. Can you recover from that?
I think you can, and I think that's happening now with a lot of the startups around the country that are making point of listening closely to their audiences and providing them what they really need, and also being transparent about what they do and how they do it, how they make their decisions. Fortunately, that's coming to vogue, but back in that day, it hadn't hit journalism yet. So I think a lot of that has to do with that transparency.
And I'm curious, when the president says the media is the enemy of the people, those are pretty shocking words, actually, from an American president. No longer shocking because he says it every day, but initially it was, because it's very un-American to say something like that. But as these outlets grow around the country, these smaller outlets, these platforms that really want to cover particularly local news, is that phrase losing some of its luster, some of its shock value?
Well, I hope so, but I do think a lot of people still believe it, and it's going to take some time for journalists to dissuade them of that. And some of it's about what journalists report on and how they report it, but it's also just about people coming to terms with a lot of what they're hearing is coming from somebody who has an agenda, and that agenda is not to bring you objectively reported news, but to bring you a point of view.
Well,
And
that's.
unfortunately, a lot of media has become politicized, polarized, and I think journalists should resist that temptation. It's important that you provide the news in an unbiased basis.
And that, to me, maybe I'm wrong about this. You correct me if I am. We lived through, you and I, and many people of a certain age, lived through a kind of golden age of relatively nonpartisan newspapers, except for the editorial pages and television newscasts. And now the reverse is true. And it's kind of a return to a form that existed throughout the 18th and 19th and 20th, early 20th centuries. Did we live through some sort of an anomaly?
Well, I suppose historians would suggest that we did, because you're right. I mean, news has long been partisan in America. You go back to the 1700s, 1800s, and you can see it quite clearly. But at some point, the people who were running news organizations came to understand that their largest audiences could be gotten through writing and reporting the news in a way that everybody could understand it and everybody could believe it. And that happened around the turn of the 20th century.
There's a reason that freedom of speech and freedom of the press is the topic of the First Amendment to the Constitution. When people agree with politicians who are attacking the press that the press is the enemy of the people, alleging that reporters and news outlets with which they disagree should be brought up on charges, and that's a quote. Do you think that these folks lack a basic understanding of what the First Amendment and what the founding principles of the country are all about, or are they actively working to undermine those principles and create something new?
The worst of them out there are actively undermining it. There are many others who just don't understand it, and so they're easily misled by those folks. And so, I think, one of the things we've lost is in our schools is the teaching of civics. A lot of our students growing up, they have no idea how their government's supposed to work, and so they end up misunderstanding who's in charge and what they can do and what they shouldn't be doing. And we've seen this quite clearly in recent times. I think that it's important for journalists to continuously remind people of how our government is supposed to work, what a democracy is supposed to look like, and to, you know, be that educator as well as just providing news.
And is the fact that civics seems to take a back seat in high schools around the country, is that deliberate, or is that just an oversight because we keep tinkering with education?
I think it was an oversight. I don't think it was deliberate. I just think that the people in charge of our schools, in trying to push in everything that they needed for their students, or they thought they needed for their students, they allowed that to fall by the wayside. I believe that that you see some of that returning, but not enough of it. There are just too many people out there who don't realize, you know, as a voter, you're supposed to be the boss. You're the person who's going to hire, who's going to do these jobs. And in order to do that well, you've got to know what they stand for and what they plan to do. And it's your right to know that. And journalists are there to help you find that out. That's the point of journalists, really. They're there to advocate for the public.
Yeah, I want not all of the criticism that has been leveled at the media is coming from policymakers and elected officials who just don't like the coverage that they're receiving and would prefer that we go away. Some of the criticism is coming from rank and file people who consider reporters particularly to be Budinskys. And this maybe it grew out of television news where they'll go to a bereaved family who has lost a family member through any number of means and have to ask them a question like, how are you feeling? Well, what a stupid question. But nonetheless, the news cycle demands it, and that's what we have to do. But you say that is not why we're not butting ourselves into things that are none of our business. You say what we do is we're doing it not for ourselves, we're doing it for consumers. I'm taking the long way around here. Why is that motivation? The fact that we're trying to uncover information for the reader, for the viewer, for the listener, why is that so often lost?
Well, I have a rule, or I had a rule in my newsrooms, and that was, and I learned that rule very hard in my own reporting, and that is, when you're going to take the public to a place where it would not have gone on its own and wishes it could wouldn't be there, it's very important that you tell them at that time why you're doing that and why it matters. And I think a lot of times journalists miss that point. They assume that the public will understand their motivation, what they're there to do and why it's important, but they need to explain it. And that was one of my early lessons as a reporter. And then later as an editor, I wrote many, many columns explaining, yes, this is tough. I'm sorry that you have to hear this, but it is important that you hear it. And here's why it's important.
In your book, you quote another editor as saying, if no one reads or watches your work, you aren't producing journalism, you're keeping a journal. And that was to illustrate that you need to find a way to make stories compelling so that people want to read them. But there appears to be a fine line between writing something or creating something or writing a headline that is compelling that makes you want to read the article and doing something that is sensational or clickbait. Is that a part of the problem with trust in the media today, the fact that the line is so frequently blurred?
This has become so much of a problem, especially with digital journalism, entertainment. It blurs, like you said, and people are too focused, journalists, I should say, are too focused on how many hits they're going to get. The important thing to remember is that as you are providing something for an audience, it's important for it to be compelling, or otherwise they'll miss the message. But it's also important that you not appear exploitive. There's no need to exploit the news. The news itself should be compelling enough.
Is it more difficult to do that in this day and age? In the old days, when the newspaper came out once a day, or maybe there were several different editions that came out throughout the day to subscribers and non-subscribers, etc. Today, the news is out minute by minute on the website, on the apps that these news organizations have. And the idea to raise the revenue that they need to even keep these smaller operations going, you have to have eyeballs. Is it more difficult to do that today, to be not sensational, but to be compelling?
It's more difficult to hold the public's interest. And you're right, it's minute by minute. I I remember when the Observer was transitioning to digital journalism, and there was a period of time there in the 2006, 2008 range where it was important for us, we realized, to be there on the web, and we had trouble with it. So,
Let me stop you there. We'll come back to that in a moment, in just a moment. Rick Thames is our guest. Why Local News is the name of his book.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte. Celebrating 95 years, United Way of Greater Charlotte supports education, financial stability, health, and essential services. Details at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today, Rick Thames, the former editor of the Charlotte Observer, but that's not the only paper he worked for in his career. He's also the author of Why Local News, a memoir and plea for an endangered form of journalism, which I want to get to in a moment. But we were talking before the break about sensationalism versus compelling stories, and how you draw that line to make sure that what you're doing is compelling and worth reading or consuming, and what is sensational and not worth reading or consuming, because once you get past the headline, there's nothing there. And that seems to have been exacerbated to a great degree by the fact that it's no longer a daily edition. It's a minute-by-minute edition of every publication out there on the web, either on platforms like websites or on apps that come to your phone. And you were talking about the Observer when it first made the transition and realized it had to be on the internet as well as in print, and how it was. I guess it was a difficult thing to adapt to.
Oh, it really was. We had great debates in our newsroom over how difficult it would be to even post a couple of stories a day on our website. And of course, we look back on that now and say, what were we thinking? But at the time, that was hard, not only because, it meant we had to change our deadlines and do things differently, but also because our reporters were reticent to put something online before it appeared in print. Of course, that was the thing of the day. But over time, we came to realize that this was our advantage. We could really keep people up to date. The temptation there is not to lead people along and mislead them about what's really happening at a given moment, but to give them, new information that really is helpful to the ongoing story. And I do see this being a problem in some news organizations where, as you say, there's just too much emphasis on hits and not enough emphasis on are you really helping your audience? I think that this is changing in some ways now because more news organizations are more reliant on their subscribers if they are for profits, and they realize that their subscribers are not looking for that. They're looking for something more substantial. And as that trend grows, I think that's helping these organizations stabilize and worry less about people flying in on the web from New York or LA, and more concerned about the people in their community and what they need.
So, Rick Thames, the name of your book is Why Local News? Why? Why Local
You think
News?
About,
Answer the
you
question.
Think about community. You think about community and how it forms, and you think about the role that a responsible, good news organization can play, helping a community come to understand itself, meeting people that it otherwise would not meet within its community. You look at how now so many Americans are feeling more isolated. They're lonelier. They don't know their neighbors. They don't even know who's going to pick up the trash or when it's going to be picked up. And they're looking for some guidance. Well, journalists can be the pathfinders in those communities. They can be the people who let you know what's happening around you. They can make your lives richer, but you need the journalist to be there to help you. And think about this. How many people have suddenly awakened to the fact that there's going to be a data center in their backyard and that all of this information could have been discovered by a responsible local news journalist had they had one, but instead local officials signed the documents and now it's too late.
Yeah, we've lost a lot, which we'll talk about, because in the heyday of The Observer, they had hundreds of journalists and editors and beats that covered the entire region. There wasn't a square inch of territory that they didn't have their fingers into. And today, just going back to the realities of today, in addition to hearing that we are fake news, which we are not, but we keep hearing that, we also hear from ordinary rank and file people that I get my news now through social media. I don't have a newspaper. I don't watch TV news. I get it through social media. I get it on my phone. And you say that getting news should make you smarter, wiser, and better prepared to help advance a free and self-governed society. And you're quick to add, you won't get there by swimming through random streams of social media. Why not?
You have no idea about the source of that information. Unless, of course, it's coming from a responsible news organization. And that social media can be helpful. But you don't get what you need. I mean, that's mixed in with all kinds of misleading messages, political venues, all of these sort of things are mixed in with that. And you're just not getting the truth as it should be reported. So you need to find someone you can trust. And you need to understand what their agenda is. Hopefully their agenda is simply to be that public trust and to help people understand themselves, their lives, and their communities better. You will not necessarily find that in social media. You'll find a lot of misleading information in social media, and you need to be very careful about that source that you're working with.
Traditional media has been facing a lot of headwinds that we've been talking about, and an alarming number of people say they no longer trust the media, but they're referring to big media usually. They're referring to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the major television news networks. On the other hand, you say 72% of Americans believe that local news organizations can be relied on to deliver the information people need and to report it fairly and accurately. And you also say that local news journalists at the same time are an endangered species. So if people trust local news outlets, and if there is a perceived need by people for those outlets, can't companies make money delivering quality product to these people? If that's the case, why are local journalists endangered?
Well, it's harder now than it was, of course, because we once had the most amazing business model in newspapers, for example, and that was advertising. And, you know, there are things to be said, good and bad, about advertising. But in my era of my career, the advertising was a reliable and very steady and rich source of revenue. And it gave us the means to have a bureau in Hickory and in Columbia, South Carolina, and in Myrtle Beach even. And so that's changed. And so it is more difficult, but we are seeing some great work being done locally, in some cases with for-profit media, in other cases, nonprofit media like yourself. And so it is still possible, but we do need more of the public to support what's being done, and they need to delineate between sources that are just there to steer them in a poor direction and sources that are there to actually help them do what they need to do in their community.
You say that there are less than 60,000 people in this country working today as full-time journalists in a country where the population is more than 350 million people.
That's right.
Put that into perspective. In terms of where the numbers of working journalists was in the 80s, in the 90s, when newspapers were still hot and when the television newscasts ruled the roost locally.
Well, there were so many in the 80s and the 90s. I don't know that anybody actually studied it, but more recently, they have studied it. And as recently as 2002, there were still enough local journalists in the United States for them to be about 40 per 100,000 people. Well, 40 people is enough people to at least keep tabs on what's happening in your community. But today, according to a study I just read, that's down to less than 8 reporters per 100,000 people. And in many communities across this country, there is no one, absolutely no one, 100 communities, 200 counties, I should say, in America now have no source of local news. And about half of the other 3,000 or so counties only have one source of local news. Usually that's going to be a weekly newspaper. And many of those weekly newspapers, unfortunately, are what we call ghost newspapers. And they're there mainly to carry advertising and not to bring you the news.
You spend some time in the early parts of your book tracing your own discovery that your path in life would be in journalism, and you write about what motivates journalists or should motivate them, and who and what journalists are and what they try to do. So take us through some of that. What is, in your mind, a good journalist? What do they do, and what motivates them to do it?
Well, first and foremost, they respect and really hold as sacred the First Amendment. That is foremost. And they are there to ensure that the needs of the Constitution are met. And that has to do with an informed public. I think there are many things that help a journalist be a good journalist, and their values, journalistic values that matter. And one of them is independence. Journalists need to be independent of any other source that might otherwise be out there to influence you in a way that has nothing to do with the public good. Journalists have to be independent. They have to be free to find what needs to be found to get to the truth. And they should be objective. And by that, what I mean is, I don't mean that people can walk around and not have any bias. We all have biases, but they've learned to set aside their biases in order to get to the facts. And that's a special kind of person. And you just won't find that person in streams of social media. What you will find is that person in reputable newsrooms, even sometimes virtual newsrooms, where that's important to them.
You also say that journalists are society's moral compass. What does that mean?
Well, early on, I came to realize that the journalists in the room were the people who said, we're here to get the truth, wherever it may fall. And that truth may hurt or it may help, but it's important that people have that truth. And often it's the journalists who are first to speak up to let you know that this is not right. It's wrong. This should not be happening. It's about human rights. It's about people watching over what matters to the public. And journalists often are the ones who have that moral compass that says, this is wrong. It's inherently wrong.
We were talking about this before we went on the air. I always thought that the Charlotte Observer was a great newspaper for a city of its size. And I arrived here in the 1980s. So I always thought, well, this is a pretty good newspaper. And I came to believe, as time went on, that I was wrong about that, that it was a great newspaper. End, full stop. Full stop. And then the digital reality that set in after the internet became supreme began to chip away at its foundations and the foundations of every major publication. And I would argue every television station that does news and radio stations that did news. And people who were not around in the heyday of newspapers have no clue what they're missing. And they probably think, well, we got it better today because we have all these different sources that we can depend on that come into my phone or my computer constantly. I'm better informed than I was when there was no internet and there was just this published printed thing that came out and was thrown on the doorstep in the morning. What are we missing today as a result of this?
A good, solid journalist. That's what we're missing. The journalist who can tell us the things that we don't know and can hurt us or can help us. These are opportunities too. And, you know, if you don't have a journalist on the ground looking around in your community and helping you make sense of it, we're missing the opportunity to be the kind of community that we need to be. And I can tell you that I came to believe early on that journalism and quality journalism in your community is just as important an asset as clean water, clean air, good schools, roads. And that brings me to something that I'm seeing that I think is exciting. And that is that many states now are beginning to get into the area of how they can help local news organizations, realizing that we're less healthy communities without them. And there's some legislation that has been passed in various states to give these local news organizations tax incentives. Sometimes the tax incentives are going to the subscribers themselves. And there's a great organization, you may have heard of it, Rebuild Local News, that is tracking this all over the country. And it will show you state by state what is happening. And go to North Carolina, and what will you see? Nothing. Nothing is happening in North Carolina right now. And I think as voters and as constituents, we need to be asking our legislators why they aren't helping in that way. And surely they know that their community would be healthier with local news.
I want to move off this topic, but I also want to underline what we have lost. And you write about it pretty eloquently in your book. The Observer's reach, you say, was extraordinary. No town within 60 miles went unnoticed. No relevant topic went uncovered by a full-time reporter or report. Healthcare, higher education, public schools, criminal justice, the environment, charities, religion, real estate, banking, the retail industry, food, books, movies, TV, classical music, pop music, gardening, and many other topics. And these were covered by beat reporters who knew the territory, who knew what they were writing about, and that seems to have disappeared. It also seems to me that you can find all of this online in various different platforms and publications, but your attention is scattered. Back then, This big thing was dropped on your doorstep in the morning, and maybe it took you all day to read it. Or maybe the Sunday paper probably took several days to read because there were so many sections in it. But you could focus on things. That's gone too.
It is. And you're right. There are many, many organizations in Charlotte, for example, that are covering some aspect of the news, and some of them are doing a great job. I mean, we have, you know, everything from North Carolina Health News to Soccer Sheet, and they run the range. And by the way, are you familiar with the new study that's just been done by the TOE Center for Digital Journalism out of Columbia University?
No.
That study, which was just released in April, did an in-depth look at the nature of our news ecosystem in Charlotte. Charlotte was chosen out of any other place in the country to go in deep. And it found that there were 33 organizations that were doing what it called original news. So it was producing news that itself, not just aggregating it from other places. And those 33 organizations, though, were fragmented, and they were in all kinds of places. And as you say, we don't really have the time to run around and find all that. But now people are looking at news as more of a niche, whichever you want to call it. And yeah. And the point is that we don't have time for that. And it's a very difficult system for us to have to navigate.
In North Carolina, because we have elections every year, we're always in an election season. We're coming up to a pretty important election, the midterm elections, which may or may not determine the control of the House and Senate in Washington, and that may or may not affect the administration and what it intends to do over the next several years. And I want to talk about how we cover elections today and a discovery that the Observer made and how to cover them differently that actually made a difference. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Rick Thames is our guest. He's the former editor of the Charlotte Observer and the author of a new book about journalism called Why Local News, a Memoir and Plea for an Endangered Form of Journalism. As I mentioned, we're heading into the midterm elections, an important election. Some say the future of democracy is at stake here, given the actions that we've seen unfold at the Trump White House. And Trump says our election system is rigged. We know that that is unequivocally false, but again, you say it enough times and it becomes true to a lot of people. So we're witnessing a national battle of ideologies about what this country should be. North Carolina also, it seems to be at the epicenter of this and may play a pivotal role in control of the Senate because we have this contest between former Democratic Governor Roy Cooper, who has never lost an election, and former GOP chair Michael Whatley, who has never been in an election because he's never held elected office. But you covered, in your time at The Observer, another consequential Senate race in North Carolina between Republican Jesse Helms and former Democratic Mayor of Charlotte, Harvey Gantt. This, too, was a battle of ideologies. Old versus New South, civil rights icon versus openly former open segregationist, black progressive against white conservative. It almost seems to be a microcosm of our national political struggle today. Is it? Has anything changed?
There are a lot of similarities. That race was, at least for me, the earliest where I could see that there were some pretty unseemly things being done on the campaigns. And this campaign in particular, I felt like Jesse Helms was taking advantage of race and other issues. But, you know, it's interesting that we tried very hard to keep people focused on issues. And we did, I think, to a large extent. But in this particular campaign, the one you just mentioned, it was difficult to overcome people's notions of race. I really believe that was what happened there.
And you also write about how different these two candidates were, how Jesse Helms was constantly bashing the state's biggest newspapers, including The Observer, for giving better coverage to liberals because the newspapers wanted liberals to win. Not true. That was aimed at The Observer when you were at the paper. And you vowed to make sure that your coverage as a result was accurate, fair, and balanced. Do you think you succeeded in that effort?
I think we did. And I think down ballot, you could see the effects of that in that 1996 election. And the reason you could see it was because we took a different approach to the election. We began to talk to voters about what they needed to know, as opposed to just listening to what the candidates said they wanted to do. And that really turned the tables for most of the races in North Carolina in that year.
Let's talk about this. You discovered during that race, the initial poll conducted by the Charlotte Observer that gauged the horse race between these two candidates had Harvey Gantt ahead. The final poll before the election had Harvey Gantt ahead. Mm-hmm. It may have changed a little bit in between, but he was always ahead, beginning and end. But Helms won that election, 53-47%. We've just witnessed this, whether it's Wisconsin or Michigan, I don't remember, but the polls were wrong about who won certain elections up there. And in your time, the result of the election did not match the result of the polls, and that shocked you and publisher Rich Oppel, or editor Rich Oppel, which led him to investigate a new kind of political coverage that you've just alluded to that was taking place in Kansas, public or civic journalism. What is civic journalism? How did it change your approach to covering elections?
People will describe it in a lot of ways, but basically what it is it's giving the citizen who becomes voter what that citizen needs to know in order to make a good decision at the ballot box. And often that's not what the politician is talking about. In fact, you see that more today than ever. Politicians are hitting on hot buttons, things that they're trying to sway the voter one way or another based on dreadful assumptions about this thing or that thing that supposedly a candidate did. And when really what the voters want to know is who is helping me, who's going to help me if they're elected. And so in 1992 first, and then again in 1996, The Observer turned the tables and we said, let's find out what voters need to know. And that kind of polling, issues polling, became very popular during that period. And in 1996, it became so popular that we succeeded in working with the Raleigh News and Observer, and we actually created a coalition of 16 news organizations across the state that looked at that agenda and said, no matter what else we do, we're going to make sure that we cover what our voters have told us that they need to know.
And it wasn't just asking the voters what were the issues that were important to them in their daily lives. It was then posing those questions to the candidates and making them answer the answer the questions. And if they didn't answer them, you would publish white space. You did that. You did that for Terry Sanford, I think. And the white space, he didn't answer. So we have this column of nothing speaks volumes.
Right. And then he began to answer questions. So, you know, today we are hearing about candidates who are avoiding certain media. And because they can go and pick and choose what media they want to talk to, I think our media today could learn from that lesson of 1996, which is working together, you can force a candidate to talk about the things that voters need to hear about. And you should look into that. That kind of collaboration would be very helpful.
Did it make a difference? Did it change the outcome of elections? Did it change how candidates conducted their campaigns or served their constituents once they got into office?
Well, that I can't tell you for a fact, but I can tell you that the candidates they recognized that the media had turned the tables on them, and they realized that they needed to talk about education, they needed to talk about taxes, they needed to talk about the economy, and they needed to have concrete plans for voters to look at. So it did make a difference in the conversation across the state, and I think it was helpful. It was of least interest, unfortunately, at the time to the journalists outside of the state, and we were criticized for it. And because that was in the era when it was believed that journalists have to decide what the news is, that the public is not supposed to be a part of that. Today, you're finding more and more startup organizations are saying, no, it is, let's turn the tables. It is about what our people need to know. And they're changing the way they cover politics in many places. In fact, Colorado Public Radio did this the last election. And it did, in fact, poll their communities on what people wanted to know, and they made sure that their candidates were addressing that.
In the early days of your taking this approach, you referenced this in the 1992 election, you say people were angry about politicians listening only to lobbyists, stopping negative advertising, breaking their promises, and getting nothing done. That was in 1992. They still are. The same thing is true right. today.
So, still are.
So did your approach work? Did it have any lasting impact?
I think it can work. It would work. I think if we saw more journalists who decided that they weren't going to stop short of getting the answers that their readers or listeners needed, I think you would see a change, at least in the local level. I mean, this is difficult to you know, turn around across the nation, but you're here locally. A lot can change as a result of that kind of approach to politics.
So today's media is partially a victim of changing times, changing technology, the changing reality of the lives of people who consume news, who now have the whole world in their pocket at all times. So given that, how practical is it to expect that people will ever rely on a single publication like the Charlotte Observer or local TV news or even public radio for that matter for their news on any given day over every other platform available to them in their pocket on their phones?
I think that era has passed. I mean, I don't see that coming back anytime soon, but I can tell you that.
Is it sustainable? But then is it sustainable for the people who produce that news?
Well, that's the trick. And in some cases, that's happening. We have some organizations here in Charlotte that are making that work right now. And it's a tough road, but they're doing it. And I think the more people support them, the more they'll be able to do. I'll point out an example right now. Charlotte Ledger, which many people have heard of by now, is actually partnering with a nonprofit that is providing information about the election for this midterm, and it did it for the last election as well. It's called the Civic Knowledge Initiative, and the two have partnered, and they're working with each other in order to get out free, no charge, information about who's on the ballot, registration, voters, early voting, all of that is being assembled now for that to be used for anybody who's confused about what's going on here. I don't know where I need to start.
Yeah. Well, there are two different models in play here today, it seems. The for-profit model, which is the old-fashioned one, where you're depending upon advertising and subscription revenues to be able to pay your employees and gather the news and publish it. Then there's the nonprofit model. And given our struggles here at WFAE, we are the nonprofit model. Is it a practical move to make toward that model in terms of news generation?
I think it is. I think it's still possible to do with for-profit news in larger metro areas like Charlotte. I think it can still be done. But I also think if you get into more rural areas, that it's very difficult to do. And I think the nonprofit model is valid and is the way to go. You may have heard that just recently, a group called the Georgia Trust for Local News purchased two former McClatchy newspapers in Georgia. It was the Macon Telegraph and the Columbus Ledger Inquirer. And it's going to turn them into nonprofits in those communities. And there's enough happening there with donors in order to give them a chance to get started with subscriber base and with other things that will help them with their revenue. And I think that's an encouraging model to watch. I also see there have been other places in the country where that has similarly happened, and those news organizations, they're working.
When you have somebody in the Oval Office who keeps criticizing journalists and journalism and calling it fake news and enemy of the people, and when you have pretty much an entire political party in the same camp and an ecosystem of right-wing media that also hammers that home, and as I said, if you say it enough, a certain part of the population is going to believe it. Can you combat that? What has to be done to restore public trust and convince people that those people are wrong?
Well, that's a good question, Mike. It's about being consistent about what you're doing, showing people why you're doing it, and bringing them along for the journey. And I think the more a news organization does that, as I think WFAE tries to do quite a bit with its audience, the more support will come.
This is partially a memoir. We haven't talked a lot about the memoir part of this book that you've written. It's you trace your whole career from your time as a cub reporter, an intern, to eventually the editor of The Observer. And during that time, you covered a lot of major stories. You were in the right place at the right time at the right publication to cover some of these things. And one of them was the Dr. Jeffrey McDonald trial. People may not remember this, but this was as big then as perhaps the Alec Murdoch trial in South Carolina was in recent years. You were in the courtroom for the trial on the day the jury returned the guilty verdict. You were young. You were 26 years old, I think. This is the first big trial you'd really ever covered, and this was major. You even interviewed Jeffrey McDonald at the time. Remind us who he was and what he was accused of.
Sure. Jeffrey McDonald was a captain, a doctor with the Special Forces at Fort Bragg, the Green Berets. And one evening, he and his family were attacked in their home in Fort Bragg. His wife, a pregnant wife, and two small children, two daughters, were brutally murdered in that small apartment. And he had some injuries as well. And he said that this was caused by three intruders. At the time, the memory was still fresh about the Charles Manson murders out on the West Coast. And there was a lot of similarity between what happened in the Manson murders and what appeared to be happening there. Ultimately, very, very long time elapsed, but ultimately he was brought to trial in Raleigh, and a jury, North Carolinians, did convict him of murdering his own family, and he's still in prison.
And you interviewed, he's in his 80s now, you interviewed him as a 26-year-old reporter covering your first trial, a major trial, it got international headlines. And you've listened back to the tape of that interview recently. What are your impressions?
Oh, I was so unprepared. I was working with a pro. I mean, Jeffrey McDonald, by that time, he'd been interviewed by everybody. Time Magazine, you know, all the major networks. There'd been so much written and said about him. And he was very practiced at his own work, talking to a reporter. I was still learning how to form good questions. And so, fortunately, I did record some of that interview, but I learned a lot from that, and I realized that preparation for an interview is a good thing. It was really a strange experience to take him to a Pizza Hut, and where we both ordered chicken sandwiches, and
Chicken sandwiches at a Pizza Hut.
and we
I
were in a
have,
hurry.
I
Yeah,
have,
exactly. But
I have.
we ordered them because pizza might take longer, we thought, and he had to get back to the trial. So the trial was
I
ordered.
have 15 seconds, Rick. What is your advice for young journalists who may be thinking about this, or maybe decided they'd love to do it, but they can't afford to do it?
If you have a passion for it, if you care enough about this as your line of work, there is a way for you. And I just want journalists, young journalists, to know that.
Rick Thames is the former editor of the Charlotte Observer. His new book is called Why Local News, A Memoir and Plea for an Endangered Form of Journalism. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.